Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am so happy.
Yeah, I'm also so happy to be talking about movies with friends!
That's very loud. Why are you so loud right now? All right, okay, first up in controversies and non-controversies. I don't know what we should talk about this morning. I guess we probably have to talk about the FCC seeming to pressure a broadcast television network and its affiliates into taking a critic of the Trump administration off the air. Outrage ensued. We're actually taping this on Tuesday afternoon, which is unusual for us. Usually we do it Mondays. So we had a little more time. We've got a little more information to work with before you guys see this. Disney announced that they were bringing Kimmel back for tonight's show. Again, we're taping Tuesday. And also the broadcast affiliate networks owned by Nexstar and Sinclair said they weren't going to air him when he returned. So that's kind of where the state of play is right now. Just to recap everything that's kind of happened up to this point. Following the shooting of Charlie Kirk, but before the text messages of the suspect were released in which he said he assassinated the conservative commentator because, quote, I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out, end quote. Jimmy Kimmel, riffing on the matter, said, quote, we hit some new lows over the weekend with the MAGA gang desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it, end quote. Now, look, there are two ways to parse this statement. The least damning, the most generous way to parse it is to say that Kimmel was saying Kirk's allies were leaping to conclusions to scapegoat the left. Okay, and I think a lot of people have tried to make this argument. A more damning parsing, and honestly, frankly, the one I would kind of read into it, given what a lot of folks on the left at the time were saying, that Kirk's killer was a right winger, he's possibly an anti-Semitic groiper, angry that Kirk was too friendly with Israel, is that Kimmel was saying the shooter was one of, quote, the MAGA gang, end quote, and that they were desperate to reject this reality. The right was desperate to reject this reality. Two things happened almost immediately after Kimmel's comments. Conservatives were outraged, leading to more conservative-minded ABC affiliates to say they were going to pull Kimmel off of their broadcast. This is the Nexstar Sinclair segment of networks. And the FCC chair, Brendan Carr, seemed to threaten those affiliates and ABC alike, saying that Kimmel needed to be punished and that they could do this the hard way or the easy way. Again, two ways to parse this, two ways to kind of look at these statements in this situation. The most charitable way is to say that Kimmel was going to be punished anyway. He was going to get pulled off the air. He needed to do an apology, whatever. And this is what the networks were responding to. The more damning, and again, I think more accurate way, is that the affiliates knew Carr would use his power to screw up their business dealings. And Carr said the quiet part out loud. As podcaster Benny Johnson put it about his interview with Brendan Carr, quote, this is what got Kimmel fired right here, end quote. Now, of course, Kimmel hasn't been fired. He's coming back. And if Kimmel had just been suspended and or fired as a result of his speech, and purely a result of his speech, without Carr saying a thing, we'd be having a different conversation entirely about accountability culture and the such. Yes, speech is free, but it's not free from consequence. Just ask Roseanne Barr. Turnabout is fair play, et cetera, et cetera. We'd be having a whole different conversation. We'd get all the hoary chestnuts from the cancel culture wars just with the sides flipped. However, Carr did say what he said, and this ups the ante. It changes the poker game entirely. We're going from draw to, you know, Omaha. Because this is a bright line issue. The First Amendment is very clear on this. First Amendment, very clear on this. Supreme Court has ruled 9-0 on a similar issue not long ago. Government regulators cannot use their power to punish speech they do not like, period, full stop. Even Senator Ted Cruz came out against Carr's statement, which Matt Bellany and Lucas Shaw, interestingly, in their podcast on this that went up last night, suggested that this helped give Disney some cover to bring Kimmel back so quickly. There was not a unified front on the right on this. A lot of conservatives were very hesitant to back Carr's play here. You don't have to like what Kimmel said. You don't have to like what Kimmel said. You can criticize Kimmel for what he said. You can punish Kimmel for what he said. You can boycott Disney. You can boycott the advertisers. But you should absolutely hate what the government is very clearly trying to do here. out in the open and with the full power of the state behind them. Peter, I've seen some folks argue that Carr's behavior here is well within the normal bounds of FCC behavior, that this is just like regulating obscenity or attempting to punish the networks after Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction at the Super Bowl, right? Is this the case? Is that actually what's going on here? Is this well within the FCC's normal purview?
Not remotely. And in fact, the best way to think about this, the best comparison, I think, is to go back to Trump's first term. Now, Trump has been saying for as long as he has been in public life that he wants to go after public broadcasters, revoke their broadcast licenses. He has said, especially for criticizing him or saying things he doesn't like, but he's, you know, personalized all of this in the way that Trump does. But Trump's FCC chairman in his first term was a different guy, Ajit Pai. Now, you may not like Trump, and you may not even like Ajit Pai, may have some disagreements with him, but Ajit Pai made it really clear when Trump said stuff like this, that was not remotely the role of the FCC chairman or of the FCC, that was not okay. And this was a Republican Trump pick. And so now we have a different Republican Trump pick, Brendan Carr, who has billed himself as a free speech warrior. And I am sorry, you are not seeing a free speech warrior here. You are seeing somebody who has taken it as his job to be Trump's toady and shut down speech. And that is what is happening. You cannot look at the statement that Brendan Carr made on that Benny Johnson podcast, "We're going to do this the hard way or the easy way," and think of that as anything but a threat. It, within a couple of sentences of saying we're going to do this the easy way or the hard way, or what exactly, I may be slightly messing up the words there, but that's the thrust of it. Within a couple of sentences of that, he brings up, oh, you know, maybe Kimmel should face some sort of consequence here, suggests suspension. He also says that the affiliates, Nexstar, like Sinclair, these are the companies that control these affiliate stations underneath the corporate network, that those affiliates need to step up, as I believe a direct quote, right? Saying pretty directly, they need to take action here. And again, this is a guy who has purview over their broadcast licenses. And in the case of Nexstar, is going to have to approve a merger that Nexstar wants to do. And so that is, it's not a direct threat in the sense of specific words like, it's not a direct threat in the sense of me pointing a gun at somebody and saying, I'm going to shoot you if you don't do X. On the other hand, you walk up to someone, you say, look, I happen to have a gun right here. I'm standing near you. And wouldn't it be, you can do this the easy way or the hard way. And let's just talk about some things that you could do. Would you not interpret that as a threat? Of course you would interpret that as a threat. It is absolutely ridiculous that anyone is defending this as anything else. And frankly, Benny Johnson, who is not exactly the most reliable narrator of politics, Benny Johnson is saying that the reason that Kimmel, he said fired, right? But which was not accurate because Kimmel right. was suspended right. and then put back on the air. But he's saying that the reason that Jimmy Kimmel faces consequences from the network is because of what Carr said on his show. That was the explicit and clear purpose. Maybe not explicit. That was the clearly implied purpose of what was said here. And the only thing that wasn't done was to make it perfectly and unmistakably explicit. So there is this like veneer of deniability, but it's barely a veneer. Come on, you've got to be an idiot to not see this as a threat.
Alyssa, I think we're all pretty much in agreement here. What's interesting about this story is that Disney did walk it back. I mean, there were people who thought Kimmel was fired, not just Benny Johnson, but I think a lot of people in Hollywood thought Kimmel was done. That he would not be willing to make the sort of statement that I'm sure Disney and ABC wants him to make. But on top of that, there's so much other business. And Disney seems to have walked us back a bit. We'll see what Kimmel says tonight. I don't know. There may be the statement could be entirely plaintive, and you know, I want us to think a little bit about how that walk back came to be, because there was unanimous outrage against Disney. There's often unanimous outrage, but I do think it was very pointed. Right, you had Michael Eisner coming out and saying, "Where's the Bob Iger? Where's the leadership?" You had performers refusing to go on at a Lilith Fair reunion concert, you know, for Hulu.
That'll and like show we can,
I mean, you know, we can laugh about that, but it's
Fair.
But we, you know, again, we can kind of laugh at Lilith Fair, but this is like an actual thing where artists were like, hey,
Damon Lindelof was like, I will not work with this network again.
Right. And so you had pretty unanimous and pretty vocal outrage here, which I have to think played some part in Disney walking this back. Right. Is there a lesson? I lay all this out because I want to ask if we think that there is like a game plan here for the future in similar situations.
Yeah. And I think it's worth just walking through some of the details of Disney's decision making here, because they illustrate the ways in which, you know, there's a lot of signal and noise going on here. And I think that there are ways in which this is both craven, but also a place where it was going to be easy to make a mistake on Disney's behalf, because, you know, Kimmel wanted to address it right away on the next show, which I think would have been the right decision. I'm curious to see what he has to say. I actually think it would be a good thing for someone who was out there doing on the left exactly what Kimmel was accusing the right of doing, attempting to, you know, deny any possibility that Kirk's assassin could be on their team, I say in substantial air quotes, to say, you know what, I was wrong. Like, this is what we now know this guy believes. I should not have been so quick to jump to conclusions. You know, it's like nobody wants to feel in any way like their ideas are associated with someone who does something awful. I think that would be a healthy thing for the country. And it would have been good for Kimmel to be able to do it soon. At the same time, there was some reporting that Dana Walden, who oversees Disney's TV business, was concerned about inflaming the situation further, in part because some of Kimmel's staff were getting threats. And, you know, as I think a lot of us know, it's like, it's one thing if you're Jimmy Kimmel and can hire a lot of security. It's something else entirely if you're like a writer on a TV show and all of a sudden, like, well, do I need cameras for my house? Like, are the cops going to come, you know, quickly enough if I show up? Like, that's really frightening. And if you are a responsible employer, you don't want your junior level employees to be sort of freaked out about the prospect that they could face real harm because of something that their boss said. But I do think that this was a mistake. And I do think that there has been a real sense that Hollywood in particular, which has kind of been held up as a bastion of the left, has played significant roles in shaping Americans' ideas in previous generations, has been not just kind of like down on the job, but lost at sea for a while. You know, friend of the pod, Richard Rusfield, has written about this a lot in the last 5 years, sort of asking, like, where was the entertainment industry during the pandemic? Where is it with threats to speech or, you know, the immigration crackdown or anything else? Where has Hollywood's ability to communicate about ideas gone? And, you know, nobody likes it when an employee of theirs, you know, just like says something dumb and bad and like quickly proven false. And I think that like what Kimmel said was dumb and bad and sort of quickly proven false and was sort of self-evidently hypocritical since, you know, there's, you know, but, you know, if the answer to speech in this very specific situation is like obviously more speech, right? It was a mistake. It was callous. But it was not obviously sort of bigoted or hateful. The language itself was not, you know, he wasn't like using slurs. It was not sort of a shocking departure from the persona that ABC has hired him to put on screen. And the most useful thing to do would have been for him to course correct and address it quickly, both as a matter of corporate politics and just sort of national discourse and conversation, right?
I mean, I would kind of push back. It really just depends on what he was going to say. If he was going to go out there and say, I said nothing wrong, fuck all these guys. And I think that would have inflamed things more for ABC, and yeah, that could have led to him being fired and for the show being canceled. Period.
Yes.
And I think that would have been more speech. It would have been a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think he is. I don't buy the, oh, I was just, you know, saying I don't know that I believe him if he is going to go out there and just say, I didn't mean that at all.
Yeah. And I hope he's not. I should be clear that I am. Yeah, I'm definitely saying all this on the assumption that, like, he is going to do the decent thing and be like, you know, this was. I hope he is going to respond to the sort of plain language reading of what he was saying and have some introspection. And you know what? If he's not, then I think somewhat less of him. I'm not like a huge Jimmy Kimmel fan, but that would be a shame. I also just think it's worth acknowledging that Nexstar, which is the company sort of at the core of this FCC decision, they want to acquire Tegna, which is another owner of TV stations, and Sinclair are both also going to keep preempting Kimmel. Yeah. And I think that's a shame, too, because it keeps us from getting a read on this question of how many people actually are offended by this, right? Like, part of what, you know, the obvious and most troubling part of what Brendan Carr did was behave like a mafia boss in ways that are radically inappropriate. But it also sort of muddied the waters on how many people who watched Jimmy Kimmel were actually upset about this, right? Like, it's very hard to say, like, we're facing an authentic, you know, viewer revolt and be believed when the chairman of the FCC has been like, we can do this the easy way or the hard way.
Can I jump in real quick? Because I think this is an interesting question, but I would frame it differently. I think it is pretty obvious that most people who actually watch Jimmy Kimmel were not bothered by this. But but that's because Jimmy Kimmel's audience is at this point shrunken and self-selected for people who want Jimmy Kimmel, the political pundit who occasionally tries to make a joke. Yeah. And if there is a deeper problem here, it is that the Kimmel style now rules in late night politics. And on the one hand, of course, comedy is going to be political. Comedians have a right to be political, like, there's a long history. This isn't just something that just popped up, you know, in the first Trump administration or this year. And I don't want to pretend, oh, this is some brand new thing. But in fact, over the past 15 years or so, you've seen a pretty marked shift in late night comedy, where late night comedy has become not a forum for reaching the broad middle or even a kind of, you know, even attempting to reach across any kind of aisle at all. And instead, just a place for kind of harping on a particular form of anti-Trump conservative, anti-Trump, you know, kind of pro-democratic liberal seeming politics. And again, that's their right. But that's a big shift. And I think that is what has contributed to a lot of this and a lot of the frustration with Kimmel and other hosts. We've saw this with Colbert. We saw Trump, I think, totally inappropriately call for the firing of more late night hosts after Kimmel was suspended, saying, I hope their next people who, maybe they said something about Kirk, but Trump's position was not they should be fired for saying something inaccurate about Kirk, just, oh, I think they should be next. And it's pretty clear that he doesn't like them because they're mean to him.
Right, right.
Basically been saying, anybody in the press who says something mean about me their job should be on the line in some sense. This is, to some degree or another, been his position for years, right? And it's become more specific and more intensely focused since Colbert and in the second term here. And Trump is totally out of line. And the president of the United States should not be involving himself in these decisions at all. Neither should the head of the FCC. At the same time, there is, I think, it's understandable. You can imagine it. You can get into the heads of people who are on the right, who see themselves as being completely left out of a world that was of a part of popular culture and discourse that was maybe not, you know, tuned to their sensibilities per, perfectly in the Reagan years or whatever, but it's like Johnny Carson wouldn't have done this type of routine.
Yeah.
This is not what late night was for so many decades when it was at this, like maybe not at the center of American life, but when it occupied a much more elevated position in American political discourse. Yeah. So this has changed, but this is not the government's responsibility to come in and police this. Not at all. Yeah. And so these two things have to be held separate. You can say Jimmy Kimmel and this style of barely funny, mostly political monologuing kind of sucks and we don't like it. And maybe there's maybe that means that for market reasons and for even public spiritedness reasons, the networks should be thinking about making changes. And you can also say at the same time that Brendan Carr and Donald Trump are being absolutely outrageously out of line. And this is not at all what a president and what the FCC should be doing.
Yeah, yeah. I this gets into a secondary question, which I don't know that we have time for here. But, you know, Ken White, a.k.a. Pope Hat, has been writing about this, the kind of collision between free speech culture and First Amendment discourse, and the ways in which, you know, people, you mentioned Peter specifically, you said, it's very clear that Jimmy Kimmel's audience wants this. And the people who are mad about this are not Jimmy Kimmel's audience, but that is what all of these debates boil down to on a certain level. Somebody somewhere gets offended. And so there's somebody gets canceled and, you know, whatever. That is a broader problem and discussion that we should maybe have at some point, but I think for today it is just very clearly like, hey, the FCC can't jawbone like this. Love that term.
Nope.
jawboning.
Not allowed.
That's a fun Supreme Court term. I like it. I like to throw it around. I'm jawboning these guys. I want it anyway. All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-troversy that Jimmy Kimmel got pulled off and then put back on the air? Peter?
It's a controversy that Brendan Carr stepped in like this and attempted, at least somewhat successfully, to use the muscle of the government to bully someone off of, to bully someone for speaking about politics and for sharing an opinion. That was wrong, that I didn't agree with, that I often don't agree with, but yeah. It's always a controversy.
Alyssa.
Brendan Carr's conduct is a massive controversy, and he should stop acting like a thug.
Yeah. I mean, it's very clearly a controversy here. Again, it's one of these things where, like, you don't have to like Charlie Kirk or what he says, but him being assassinated for his speech is bad, and we should all be opposed to that. And you don't have to lionize him and talk about him in terms of martyr, like he's a martyr, but like he was literally killed for speaking. Bad thing. We should not, that should be opposed vociferously. Same thing here. Jimmy Kimmel said something that is dumb. Some people I'm sure found it offensive. It just inaccurate. Regardless of what he said, the government should not be in there saying, we're gonna fuck up all your business deals if you don't punish this guy. That's like, it's fairly straightforward First Amendment violation. Very much a controversy. All right. You know, it's kind of a slow week at the movies this week. We're going to be talking about the new Paul Thomas Anderson next week, but this last weekend was just a wasteland. There wasn't anything we really wanted to talk about, but there was some movie news. Robert Redford sadly passed away at the age of 89. In my obituary for the Bulwark, I talked a little bit. I spent some time writing about his work setting up the Sundance Institute and how much that changed the shape of the entertainment industry writ large. For this episode, I want to highlight his actual acting work, since, you know, that's how most people knew him and related to him. I think we're going to focus a lot on All the President's Men here in this episode, and for good reason. But I just want to hit on a couple of other titles before we get to that. There's this bit in 3 Days of the Condor where Robert Redford is being addressed by Faye Dunaway's character. And she's been kind of like, she's been like kidnapped by him basically into being his spy assistant during his on the run efforts to escape the CIA folks who are trying to kill him. And as they're parting, she has this to say to him, quote, "You have good eyes, not kind, but they don't lie and they don't look away much and they don't miss anything," end quote. I think that that is a fairly good summation of Robert Redford as a kind of presence, as a screen presence. I wouldn't go so far as to say he never had kind eyes, but it is a good encapsulation of his overall look. He always, as an actor, as a character, he always looks like he's working the angles, like he's always making a calculation. You know, I mean, of course, this applies to something like The Sting or Sneakers or whatever. And it's very much a key to the success of All the President's Men, a movie that involves almost entirely just people talking sometimes to each other, to another person. A lot of the time, just talking on the phone. It's just a camera on Robert Redford talking into a phone. And you can only understand the scenes if you're watching Redford's eyes to see what matters that is being said. Right. It's really a fascinating piece of, I'm not an actor. I would not be, but I could only imagine being an actor watching that and being like, how do I do this? Cause this is how you act. This is how you act, people. Maybe my favorite Redford movie is a late addition to his canon. It's called All Is Lost. And this is, again, it's a movie told entirely almost through Robert Redford's eyes. He's on screen by himself for nearly the entirety of the movie, trying not to drown in the middle of the ocean, right? It's just him looking distraught or looking nervous or looking determined to survive this ordeal he's found himself in. Redford is, of course, best known for his work in the 1960s and 1970s. By 1974, he was the biggest movie star in the world, according to a poll of theater owners measuring who puts butts in seats. And he really does, or did, I guess, embody a very particular sort of all-American type, right? He's got that kind of like shaggy, sandy hair. He's got that wry smile. He's a little bit taciturn. He's got those piercing eyes. It's a sort of look that Harrison Ford would master in the 1980s and 1990s. Ford's a little more mumbly and all shucksy. And then his real heir, the guy who exists now as Robert Redford, basically, is Brad Pitt. That kind of like shaggy, sandy hair, a little bit quiet, likes to look at things. Just an absolute type. And they're, I want to say, kind of the first of that type. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing some folks. Despite really mastering the movie landscape and the cinema of the paranoid 1970s and All the President's Men and 3 Days of the Condor, I think it's worth highlighting that these two movies, which are very much Robert Redford productions, I think All the President's Men, even in the title card, is like a Robert Redford and Alan J. Pakula film, which I don't know that I've ever seen before in the pre-credits. Both of these movies end with what we might almost think of as an optimistic view of things, right? All the President's Men had history to rely on, of course. It ends with a list of all the people who paid for the crimes committed during Watergate. 3 Days of the Condor ends in front of the New York Times building, with Condor himself telling a CIA handler that he's told the paper his story. They're going to blow this whole thing wide open. You know, it just feels very quaint now. It feels like, oh, yeah, that's how things get done. That's how we make change in the world. Alyssa, you're a now former postie. Was All the President's Men as important to people in the offices there as outside of it?
Yeah, look, I think that All the President's Men and Watergate are, and the Pentagon Papers, are sort of inextricable from the Post self-image, right? Both inside and outside of the building. And during my last job at the Post, I was the letters editor. And so, you know, I was reading a lot of what people were coming in and saying was important to them about the Post. And it was amazing. And I think, actually, when you think about it a little bit, kind of troubling for the brand, that the thing that people still associate with the Washington Post is Watergate, right? Like nothing in the 50 years, nothing the Post has done has sort of eclipsed that as an act of reporting and of internal and external myth making. And, you know, it's sort of amazing that that All the President's Men does that in spite of the way that it sort of portrays the Post itself, right? I actually started my career at the Post in the newsroom that is depicted in All the President's Men, and it is exactly as like claustrophobic and cluttered and weird as the movie suggests it is, right? Like, this is not a glamorous space. It's like, it's full of newspapers. There are not that many windows. There was definitely a rat problem. I was in overflow seating, so I sat in the archives a lot of the time. But there was this real sense that, you know, you were where history was being made. And, you know, I think that All the President's Men is, there are very few movies that have managed to make journalism compelling while also portraying it as accurately as All the President's Men does, right? Like Spotlight is one of the few in the sense that it's, you know, it manages to make enormous human drama out of sort of the act of reporting and being reported on. Shattered Glass, you know, I think, again, it's like gets at sort of the grubby kind of claustrophobic human drama of being in a newsroom. But even by those standards, you know, Sunny, I think the things that you're saying about, you know, this is a movie that relies on Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman reacting to things, right? It relies on their eyes. There's one scene where Hoffman and Redford are, I think, having a story marked up by Ben Bradley. And I didn't notice it for the first moment, but like you just see Hoffman's leg jiggling, right? And it's like he is attempting to be cool, but there is this actual sort of violent motion going on in his upper thigh. And like that's the drama of the scene, right? It's like it's a guy sitting there with his red pen being like, can't print this, gotta go out, get more facts. Like, this is okay, but not great. And the entire tension of the scene is in that sort of jittery leg, right? I mean, this is also, there's so many things that are good about this movie. And, you know, it is a movie that not only is anchored in Redford and Hoffman's talents, but that makes excellent use of them, right? I mean, the costuming in this movie is so great. Like, Redford as Bob Woodward essentially wears the same thing throughout the movie. It's this sort of like amber colored corduroy suit. But you see so much of his character in the way that small costuming details in that suit change, right? Like at the beginning of the movie, like he's in a tie, he's wearing the jacket. And by the end of the movie, when Deep Throat has told him that his life is in danger, that it's possible that his, you know, his house and the houses of other people are being bugged, he, you know, his shirt collar is open. You can see that he's wearing like a little Cuban chain in a shirt. Like, he is changing along with the 70s, but the story itself has also changed his relationship to the establishment, right? And it's like, the movie is just full of genius details like that and just incredible shots, right? When Carl Bernstein is interviewing this bookkeeper whose house he's basically forced his way into late at night. And there is this, you know, this is a movie that has a lot of abstraction that like makes use of some of the brutalist architecture in Washington. And in this scene, you know, Bernstein is shot through the spindles of like a stair banister, right? And it's, I mean, his face is framed perfectly, but you understand in that moment that like he and the person he's interviewing are effectively sort of in prison together, right? Like they are trapped in his need to know and her desire both to reveal and to protect herself. I mean, it's an astonishing movie. It's so good. And it's so good in all those details because that's all it is, right? Like there's no chase here. There's no massive confrontation. So much of the conflict takes place sort of obliquely or indirectly, right? Like someone in the administration speaking to the editors of the Post, not by speaking to them at all, but by going on TV and making a statement, right? There is even a crucial sequence where this character Sloan, you know, who has suggested that H.R. Haldeman is involved in this slush fund, you know, comes out of a grand jury testimony and says, "I didn't name Haldeman." His lawyer says, "I didn't name Haldeman." And then you learn that he was never asked, right? I mean, this movie is just a masterpiece of detail and indirection. And, you know, Redford almost is never looking directly at the camera. He's always looking for the thing that he can't yet see. And the movie sort of forces you to do that too.
Peter, what do you make of All the President's Men just as a journalism movie? Because it is like, it's interesting. This is a movie that I imagine if you go through it beat by beat does not hew to the you know, save the cat screenplay formula. This is a weird movie that is totally compelling. I found myself over and over again watching it the other night just being like, how is this so riveting? This is not the sort of movie they make anymore.
It is not the sort of movie that they make anymore, but I actually disagree with you just a little bit. This is a genius screenplay by William Goldman that hits all of the beats, not the Save the Cat beats, because Save the Cat was published decades later. But Save the Cat is basically an adaptation of the kind of three-act structure that was in vogue in Hollywood in the 1970s that Goldman himself was a master of. And you see that mastery in this screenplay, which, again, just hits all of these beats, but in a very subtle way that doesn't announce itself. And so, for example, we have this inciting incident where Bernstein and Woodward get together for the first time when you see the Dustin Hoffman character subtly, rewriting the copy of his fellow reporter without letting him know. And it is a meet cute. It is just a meet cute that happens at exactly the moment where you have an inciting incident. And then, okay, now they're together. Now they've got to kind of figure out, are we going to work together? What are we doing here? And then they end up on the right. And then they end up on the investigation together afterwards, right? There is a debate, which is the thing that always happens after the inciting incident. There's a debate. Are we going to let these guys, these young, inexperienced, one reporter who is young and inexperienced, and the other one who is, it's pretty clear the bosses think he's a little bit half crazy, half baked, right? They talk about even how they were going to fire him, you know, a few months ago. They just hadn't gotten to it yet. He's a little bit of a flake in their perception. And so are we going to let these, like, a rookie and a screw up, basically, report out this story? And part of the reason they do, of course, is because they think that this is probably not going to pan out to be much of anything, when, of course, it's arguably the most important story in American journalism after World War II.
I was just going to add, you know, I mean, we talk sometimes about how in a good screenplay, a character wants something and needs something. And in this movie, the thing that they want and that they need and that is the journalism driver are all the same thing. It's just for different reasons, right? Like, Woodward wants a good story to be on. Bernstein, like, wants to sort of get in on the story. They both need it to, like, survive at the paper, even though they don't know it, right? Like, I don't think either Woodward or Bernstein knows that they are, you know, considered, like, not good enough when the story begins. But also, this is what journalism
is. I think Bernstein
is, like,
sort of has some sense that he might be on the outs, but he's kind of he is protective of his own image because he sees himself as this great when clearly he has not at that point proven himself, at least in the eyes of the bosses, which is how we get our initial impression of him.
The fact that the want, the need, and the, like, the driving impetus of journalism itself all converge at a single point in this movie is part of what makes the screenplay so great.
This is totally right, because every single scene is driven by that. And that's how you structure a scene. That's the sort of, you know, the kind of fundamental David Mamet theory of each of a single scene is, I just need to know what each person wants. And then the scene is just consists of
totally.
There are two or three or however many forces all trying to get something. How is it that they are trying to get it? What you see in this movie is so much of it is about Robert Redford's character wanting something. And that is all the stuff that you're talking about with his eyes and with his watching, and also just with the intonation of his voice. What he wants is to find out. He gets the bug. It is almost like he gets a less weird, less aggressive version, actually, of what you see in Zodiac with the cartoonist, the Jake Gyllenhaal character, another great journalism movie, who gets a kind of bug to figure out who the Zodiac killer was. But in this case, Redford gets that bug, and he gets it in a more earnest and more sort of traditionally heroic kind of journalistic way. In a way that you asked me about what this movie meant to me as a journalist, this was a movie that I watched obsessively and repeatedly in my late teenage and early college years, before I knew I wanted to be a journalist. before I had kind of understood that I was that was the kind of writer that I was going to be. I thought, oh, if I'm going to be a writer, I'm going to write screenplays or I'm going to write novels or something like that. I didn't really think of myself as somebody who would go work for a newspaper or a magazine type, you know, a news outlet. But I watched this movie over and over again, and I wouldn't say that it helped attract me to the to reporting, but it gave me a kind of respect for it. And I think this movie does a one of the things that it does is it does a very good job of showing you how reporting works, why it's valuable, and how difficult it is. And particularly, it's fun and funny to watch now in our digital era, where so much of the information that they could that they struggled to get is now just easily Googleable. I mean, literally, just the names of public officials. So there are a bunch of scenes in this film that are built around, well, I got the guy's last name, and I think, and like the general
office. I think he's
in
Minneapolis.
Right? Yep. Like the state and town, maybe, right? But like you then have to figure out, right? Using analog sources, using all this kind of old school reportorial, tricks, how to get that information. And then also how to be absolutely sure that you are right. Because again, this is so much of this is just what is being told to you over the phone. This isn't something where you can go back and look at the official record on, say, the state of Florida's, you know, website for this is who is the comptroller or whatever the position is, in a way that's like just easy to sort of go back and reconfirm. You don't need a second source on that now, because it's very clear when the state of Florida says this is the person, right? Like you can just like, but now they've got are we sure that we've gotten this correct because we're here in Washington, all of this stuff. And what Redford does in all of this is he draws you in into that want and into that story and into that narrative of needing to know, but also of needing to be right. And this is the thing that this movie gets at so well that is, I think, sometimes actually lost in journalism, but also overlooked and misunderstood about journalism by people on the outside, is that the best journalists become absolutely consumed, not just by the desire to know, but by the anxiety and the determination to make sure that they are actually accurate and correct. And again, that's unfortunately not always true. And sometimes the critics are right. But I think frequently people are like, oh, all journalists are trash. Oh, they just don't know what they're doing. I mean, there are many good criticisms to make of journalists. They often don't get stories right. They often misunderstand things. But the best journalists go to sleep every night with like a little pang in their gut, in their conscience.
Yeah.
Did I get that right? Did I make a mistake? And you see that here with Redford's character over and over again. He is the voice in this story who between the two reporters who is saying, no, we didn't get it, when they don't have enough sources. No, we don't know if this is right. And Redford's gift here, his genius, is making that kind of weird desire that is not actually a normal thing that a lot of people go through. Most people, when they tell stories, they want the story to be good. They want it to serve themselves. What Redford's character here wants is to serve the true thing that actually happened more than anything else. That is his highest goal and priority in life. And you become involved in that as a viewer.
And if I can just add one final thing, Sonny, I swear. One of the things this movie does very well is uses Redford's just like sheer physical gorgeousness to get audiences used to the idea that part of being an excellent journalist kind of means being an asshole. And you see that in the very first scene in the courtroom, where he's following this lawyer around the room. But as the movie progresses, you see that there's a fundamental cruelty to the search for truth, right? Because most of the people that Woodward and Bernstein are sort of tracking down and harassing and pressing are not all the president's men, right? Like, they're ordinary men and women who know something, but who are hugely vulnerable, right? I mean, you know, there's this young guy who quit his job. He has a pregnant wife. He's trying to do the right thing. And like, by the end of the movie, he's pretty much unemployed and destroyed, right? Like, he cannot get a job because he's being summoned into a grand jury. You know, they're barging in on people who are scared of being exposed and being exposed to the power of the presidency. And you know, that's like, I think that's when journalists talk about kind of objectivity and not being partisan, that's kind of, it's not in the sense of sort of party registration or having, you know, a particular view of the world. It's being on the side of the story, even when that means not acting in the way that you would just in ordinary social interaction or in like an office environment with a colleague.
The best
example
of this is the scene or sequence with another reporter, a female reporter, who overheard something over drinks from someone that turns out to be relevant. And it happens to be that she heard it over drinks in her apartment and the guy is married. And the question that Redford's character asks her is something to the effect of, are you sure he wasn't just saying this to go to bed with you?
Yeah.
Right? Like a very awkward, very direct question to ask a colleague, right? This is not the sort of way you would talk to a colleague normally, right? Like, isn't this guy just trying to impress you so that he can sleep with you? And she is a reporter. And even she is a little bit taken aback by this. She kind of understands what's going on and she doesn't sort of say that's not appropriate. But what she says is something to the effect of, boy, you guys just go right for the jugular.
And that's what the job is.
All right. Exit question. One other Robert Redford movie, Alyssa, that you like. Just recommend. Throw it out there.
3 Days of the Condor. Great.
Okay. Peter.
Oh, man. I'm actually kind of a big fan of Spy Game. It's not the greatest movie, but Redford is so good in it. It makes such good use of his particular on-screen charm.
I'm going to go with The Sting, which I watched for the first time not long ago, like a year or two ago, and is totally charming and is, I remember thinking at the time, like, yeah, this did pretty well, right? And looked it up. And it is, adjusted for inflation, like the 21st highest grossing film of all time domestically still. And I was like, oh, well, I don't know if it was that charming, but it was pretty charming. Guy was a Robert Redford, Paul Newman charmers, those two. People loved him. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Dante DeChico. Tell your friends, strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SundayMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.